I decided to use my time preparing for this meditation to understand what it truly means for the church and Christians to say Black Lives Matter. It's in this vein I ask you to join me this morning in delving into a very tough topic. I want to state up front that I can only speak from my perspective, which will definitely not apply to everyone who is listening. I don't pretend to speak for all of us, and what I say is not meant to call anyone other than myself out. Rather, I acknowledge and am grateful for the diversity in our midst, and I am also truly challenged by my time at MFM, the sermons and conversations over lunch, which have taught me about caring for our Indigenous and refugee brothers and sisters. Clearly, as a community, we are not starting this conversation on racism and white supremacy at zero. This morning, I hope to continue an ongoing dialogue where we truly challenge ourselves on affirming Black lives. Those of us who are white have a step further to go, challenging our own position in a racist society, acknowledging we can't simply opt out of living in white supremacy by saying, I'm not a racist, and taking active steps to be an anti-racist. In the same vein, this morning, when I speak in the collective, us and we, I'm using it to refer to those of us who benefit every day from white privilege, may or may not relate to what I'm saying. In an effort of full disclosure, as the topic is of a personal one, a bit about me. I'm a white, master's educated woman of Christian heritage, both evangelical and Mennonite, who grew up in an all-white town in Nebraska, a tiny town of 5,000 people, hours away from the nearest shopping mall. But the story of my family's privilege begins, as many other Americans and Canadians of European descent, with a gift of free land. This morning, I'm going to read from this book, and I've lost my place. Okay, so this book is written by my great uncle. It's called From the Steppes to the Plains, A Personal and Family History. And it's actually about our Mennonite family history and all the way back to the 1600s, and then mostly, though, about coming to the United States and what happened after that. So the little portion I'm going to read is entitled Cornelius Zilke and the Oklahoma Land Run, 1889. By 1889, after 7 years of marriage, my grandparents had acquired 2 children, but not much else, especially in the way of earthly goods. A friend told them that they had heard about a chance to participate in a run for free land in the, quote, unassigned lands of Indian Territory, and that a group of them were planning to try their luck. Cornelius decided to join. On the morning of April 22, 1889, they were lined up as near to the northern boundary as they could get. Grandpa's wagon was drawn by 2 horses, one white, one black. At a high noon, the signal to start the race was given. Amazingly, within an hour, and after racing only a few miles, Grandpa and his relatives had each successfully staked claims to 160 acres of free land. After they had paid a small filing fee and registered their claim, they returned to Kansas from Oklahoma, rejoicing, telling their families that the, quote, the good Lord had protected them, and now they were looking forward to a new start in Oklahoma. The 89ers who settled in Oklahoma during the first land run are famously celebrated, these are the words of my great uncle, so by the non-Indians. It was perfectly legal invasion from their perspective, but nothing more than another land grab by property-hungry non-Indians from the Native American perspective, and certainly nothing to celebrate. The Zilkes were among a handful of Mennonites who participated in the run, and were likely totally oblivious to the Indian point of view, as I was until I began to study Indian history in graduate school. So this was quite eye-opening to me. I knew in general about land runs and land grabs, but it made it very personal. Not only did my Mennonite family come to the United States of their own free will to seek a better life, but upon arrival, they were given free land by the U.S. government. we began our generational accumulation of wealth immediately upon arrival to the US. Within one generation, even my great-grandfather was able to go to college. Meanwhile, the descendants of Africans who toiled the land for untold generations were not only not given the free land my family was given, but were denied the education my family was easily able to access. So let's fast forward to today and how this incredibly unequal starting point leaves us. It is well documented that longstanding structural and systemic inequalities and ongoing racial bias have resulted in Black communities in the US and in Canada being disproportionately impacted by COVID-19. Since the start of the pandemic, Montreal districts with higher numbers of Black people with more cramped housing have registered the most cases. In Montreal Nord, more people have died from the virus than in all of British Columbia. Unlike much of the rest of Canada and the United States, Quebec has not disclosed data on race, which is a very touchy subject, I understand, but this is despite calls of community activists such as the Côte des Neiges Black Community Association and Hoodstock in Montreal Nord, who say this information could have been used to identify and protect vulnerable communities. Underpaid healthcare workers who lacked private transportation living in these high density apartments has led to a much wider spread of infection rate than in other neighborhoods. The pandemic reveals to us clearly systematic racism, but many of the signs the rest of us see in our offices, schools, and neighborhoods are much less pronounced. When I was working at the US consulate here in Montreal, a Black female colleague was pulled over by the police and questioned at length. They wouldn't believe a woman of African origin was an American diplomat and should rightfully be driving a car with diplomatic plates. It took calls from all of our top leadership to resolve the situation and convince the police to let her go. Meanwhile, as you can imagine, I never experienced anything similar to this. Another friend here in Montreal was questioned in an interview for a teaching job about whether she was, quote, a real Canadian, implying some passport holders are not qualified for the job and might not be real Canadians. A friend who is a Canadian citizen of Haitian descent works for the Canadian federal government. He tells me colleagues have asked him several times, but wait, how did you get this job? Don't you have to be Canadian to work here? A colleague of Asian heritage in Washington, D.C. told me a story about how she was on the metro. She was wearing a mask and another man pointed at his mask and pointed at her, saying, "This is an Asian problem." When my colleague arrived at work, she shared this story with a white female colleague. The white colleague just responded and said, "Well, Pam, don't take it too personally. Aren't you glad things are just so much better than they used to be?" Finally, and one of the hardest for me to deal with, is a Black colleague who recently pointed out to myself and our other white colleagues that we had micromanaged and acted condescendingly to our Black colleagues and treated them differently than we treated others. So what do we do? From COVID to condescension, clearly the church must act. Those of us of privilege must acknowledge it rather than simply disavowing it. We must take concrete actions to be present for these tough conversations and be reliable allies for change. I turned to the Mennonite Central Committee website for tools to discuss race, and that pointed me towards Laila Said's book, Me and White Supremacy. Said notes that the first step is for white people to acknowledge our white fragility. This was a totally new concept for me. It refers to when even the smallest amount of racial stress becomes intolerable, triggering a range of defensive moves. The privilege of whiteness means being able to ignore your race and not discuss racism daily, leaving conversations of racism to be shallow and binary. This is definitely true when I think back over the conversations about racism I had as a kid in public school. Racists were portrayed as bad, mean people. It seemed to me that all the racists had either changed their minds or simply disappeared after Martin Luther King Jr. set them straight with his I Have a Dream speech. Sure, some states in the South still apparently had some people in them who were racist, but that's why the federal government kept them in line. This simplistic narrative left me incredibly ill-equipped for racial discussions later in my life when my own privilege was called out. If our understanding of racism does not include colonization, discrimination, marginalization, my own family's free acquisition of Indigenous land, we will struggle with conversations about race. If racists equal bad people, we'll assume our individual goodness is being questioned rather than our complicity in a system of oppression designed to benefit us. This was an issue my colleagues and I had to take very seriously when the Black colleague told us that we were speaking in a condescending tone to her. We do not see ourselves as part of the problem. We cannot be part of the solution. This makes us an unreliable ally for people of color because we do not have the resiliency needed to talk about racism. Compounding our perceptions, and once again, like I mentioned at the beginning, when I say our, as a white woman, I'm talking about white privilege and a white perspective, but I don't mean to speak on behalf of anyone or put words in anyone's mouth. But compounding our perceptions of not being part of the problem is the fact that many of us have only been educated through a white biased narrative. I was surprised this month to learn George Washington did not in fact have wooden teeth like we had all learned, but had a set of dentures made from human teeth, likely pulled from his slaves. Sayed's book specifically took to task what she called, quote, progressive, liberal, spiritual white people who hold a belief that being these things makes you exempt or above racism. She went on to say these beliefs make religious white people dangerous to people of color because we cannot see our own complicity and we will not listen when it's being reflected back on us. This is particularly troubling as someone who considers myself spiritual and wants to do the right thing. Of course, this conversation brings us to the letter from Birmingham Jail, written in 1963 by Martin Luther King Jr. I'm sure many of you have read the letter before, and it was highly impactful to me as a college freshman when I was just starting to think about systemic racism. Dr. King writes, "I must make two honest confessions to you, my Christian and Jewish brothers. First, I must confess that over the past few years, I have been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in his stride toward freedom is not the white citizens counselor or the KKK, but the white moderate, who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice, who constantly says, I agree with you in the goal you seek, but I cannot agree with your methods of direct action. Who paternalistically believes he can set the timetable for another man's freedom, who lives by a mythical concept of time and who constantly advises the Negro to wait for, quote, a more convenient season. Shallow understanding from people of goodwill is more frustrating than absolute misunderstanding from people of ill will. Lukewarm acceptance is much more bewildering than outright rejection." So Reverend Dr. Kelly Brown Douglas is an Episcopal priest and author of the book Stand Your Ground, Black Bodies and the Justice of God. She brings this conversation to the modern day, and I'll close with some of her powerful thoughts. She writes, "Choosing whiteness, even when it is simply a passive refusal to confront what it means to be a beneficiary of white supremacy and its legacy, is an immoral choice. As such, it betrays our common humanity as equal children of God. For the Christian faith community, whiteness further belies our core identity as a faith tradition with the crucifixion at its center. That Jesus was crucified and refused to save himself from being crucified reveals that he emptied himself of all privilege that might separate him from the victims of the deadly political, cultural, and religious realities of his day. The cross, for its part, tells of God's affinity with victims. At the end of the day, God calls us to a future where the first are last and the last are first. Such a future does not reflect a reversal of privilege and penalty. Rather, it is a time when there is no first or last because everyone is treated and respected as equal child of God that they are. It is left for faith communities to repair the breach between the present injustice and God's just future."